Take the bass line out. Uh-huh.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knox podcast. I am Danf Valley, coming at you this time without my co-host, Andy Bailey. We are, however, as we near the very end of our season preview train, pleased to be joined by Adam Spinella, the assistant men's basketball coach at Washington and Jefferson. He also writes for our own NBA Math, in addition to B-Ball Breakdown, and as a contributor for Fast Model. He is a very busy guy. He's going to grad school, too. Hopefully he's okay with me divulging that. How are you doing tonight, Adam?
I'm doing great, Dan. It's again, exciting time to be this close to the regular season start. A lot of news coming out, whether it's trades, roster decisions being finalized, injury news, and you know, I'm sure we'll cover all that that's pertinent to the Spurs here tonight, but it's just exciting to be talking basketball and not have to wait much longer in order to see what we're talking about come into play.
It's great because, as you just said, Spurs, I don't even know if I led with that we were talking about the Spurs, but we're talking about the Spurs, and it's fitting that we waited this long to get it done because we're recording this on a Friday night, and a couple hours before we jump on, we find out that Kawhi Leonard will not be available for their season opener because of his quad injury. And that kind of, I don't know what the word would be, but like that, this is kind of par for their offseason course. It's just been weird for them. They gave Pau Gasol all that money after he opted out, which you can only think had to do with he was doing them a solid so they could try and get FaceTime with big names that they ended up not going after. They paid Rudy Gay. The mid-level exception is fine, but he's over 30, coming off an Achilles injury. They're kind of thin up front all of a sudden. You think they're going to play some small ball because Gay is there, but what happens if he's not healthy? And most definitely, what happens if Kawhi Leonard isn't healthy for a little bit at the beginning of the preseason? Do you turn to Davis Bertans a lot more? Is Kyle Anderson all of a sudden a big part of this team? So especially now that we've gotten this news about Kawhi Leonard, and we know that Tony Parker's not going to be ready, what was just your general impression of this Spurs offseason?
You know, general impression is one of I'm a little bit more pessimistic than I am optimistic about it, and I think there's two paths you can take with this, right? The Spurs have definitely tried to reshape their roster and retool kind of the way that they're attacking Golden State, because Golden State's the enemy right now. Mm-hmm. And in the past, they've tried to do the stick with their two big men and try to exploit the differences in the matchups with Golden State. Whereas now this summer, it kind of feels like they're conforming to the Warriors and trying to play smaller with more length on the wings and the ability to switch matchups at the forward spots and stretch the floor a little bit more. There's something to me, maybe it's because I am a basketball coach and I think of culture on a team as being so sacred, but there's something that's very upsetting about seeing San Antonio try to conform to somebody else to some degree. That there's always been this magic and this mystical aura about what Greg Popovich does with his team. And now to see that they're essentially changing the way that they do things a little bit in order to match up with somebody else, it's a very uncomfortable feeling for a lot of Spurs fans or those who study the Spurs closely to be in.
Yeah, it is really weird. And you wrote about this in depth, is that they're earlier in the over the summer, they're just adjusting to small ball mania, it seems. And it's not like we don't necessarily, they haven't come out and said it, I don't think, to date, but you just look at their roster makeup and you see it. I mean, Pau Gasol and Joffrey Lavernier are basically the only centers on this roster, which leads you to believe that LaMarcus Aldridge will be playing some more five. And we know that he doesn't like to play five, but we also know now that he was open with Greg Popovich about how unhappy he was the first 2 years in San Antonio. So maybe you're able to try and find common ground there. We also know that he hinted at maybe shooting more threes. So the signs kind of point to their going smaller. At the same time, they're not even coming close to rivaling the Warriors because they don't have, you know, Rudy Gay's not all of a sudden going to be this switchy wing, unless you think Kyle Anderson is all of a sudden going to be this, like, Joe Ingles type player, or if you're expecting to get more than anticipated out of rookie Derek White, or you think DeJounte Murray is just going to be spectacular. It's very – they're in this weird limbo to where it almost doesn't feel as if we can do what we've done for the past, you know, 5, 6, 7 years and say, well, they're the Spurs, so they're just going to churn out 55, 60 wins, and that'll be that.
Yeah, and you know, you look at a team that makes all these changes to their roster, and the last thing that I worry about with anything with Popovich is the offense. The way that they're going to play is they're still going to move the ball and be one of the best passing teams in the NBA. They're going to shoot a high percentage from three, and they're not going to take bad looks. They're going to run the right stuff on offense. That's not really a concern when it comes to this. It is, like you said, the defense, because Rudy Gay has not had a considerably high ceiling there. And as a veteran, you always think that they're on the downward slope once you hit 30 years old in terms of defensive output. Who's their best rim protector, Dan? Like, who's the guy that does the best job protecting the rim for the Spurs?
It might be LaMarcus Aldridge at this point. I mean, because they're rim protectors. Like, Pau Gasol is a pretty good rim protector for them because they find these ways, or they have to date, of being able to make these guys basically stationary guys. Like, they're not going to have to jump out on the perimeter and try and muck up all these different pick and rolls or you know, on these closeouts, because the Spurs' wing defenders, Danny Green and Kawhi Leonard, they're so suffocating and on point when you're defending on ball that there doesn't need to be a ton of help there. What happens if Kawhi Leonard is out for 10 games, though? Like, and I just don't, yeah. I mean, what is Rudy Gay going to do for you at the four now all of a sudden? Yeah, you know what? He's a good fit offensively still at the four, most definitely. What happens on defense now, though, where he's always been at his best, maybe slightly above average, maybe a replacement level player or something like that there? If he's not going to be good defensively, now all of a sudden you have these centers making these rotations or having a journey a little bit further away from the restricted area, in which case I have no idea who their best rim protector would be.
Yeah.
Who would you have right now?
I think it's probably Gasol, just because he's a little more crafty than Aldridge. But I mean, it's a toss up, and either way, it's not good. Right? that's really what we're debating here is my crap better than yours? I don't think the Spurs are going to be a great defensive team on the interior that they have been in the past. They've been one of the top defensive units, if not the top defensive team, for close to a decade. And it's really hard for me to see a team that at some point is going to trot out an older Tony Parker, an older Pau Gasol. We don't know what shape Kawhi Leonard is in right now. Granted, it's a long season, but they also have LaMarcus Aldridge, who is this mismatched. He's not great defending at the five. He's not going to be good defending at the four. There's just a lot of questions defensively for these guys. And Pop is going to do his part to create the schemes that work best for them. They'll ice or downside ball screens, which means they're trying to force the ball handler away from using the screen and keep him pinned on the sideline. And then they'll probably play a very drop back type of coverage on middle ball screens, which keep their big guys like Gasol and Aldridge away from the perimeter and dare their opposing ball handlers to come off these screens and shoot it in the mid range or try to attack them and finish over length. I think that the negative of that, by trying to protect those big guys, is that you let your guards kind of ping around over screens, you know, possession after possession after possession, and it wears down on you. Guys like Patty Mills or Danny Green or DeJounte Murray are going to have a really tough time defending all of the ball screens that they're going to try to put them in as they attack guys like Gasol and Aldridge.
And you know, and you talk about what they're going to do in these adjustments they're going to make, and what gives me this is probably blind hope in them because the personnel is so different, and again, the front court rotation is so wonky, but they just know how to game the regular season system. Like, they're just going to attack you defensively if you're even like just not a half step on point on offense, and then they're going to grind you down at the other end on their own offense and milk the clock and make you defend for a full 22 to 24 seconds, and that might help them survive with, you know, we'll say without Kawhi Leonard, because they outscored opponents during the regular season 6.6 points per 100 possessions when he wasn't on the floor. again, it's a little bit different now, but even if, you know, he comes back, you don't have Parker, you don't know when you're going to have Parker, you don't really know what to expect from the point guard position anymore, because you figure they're going to lean on DeJounte Murray and Patty Mills. It's just, there's so many more question marks, but because they're so schooled in the regular season art form of how to get the most out of whoever's on the floor just by being consistent and knowing what they want to do and how they're going to do it, I think they won't have a problem getting to 50 wins, even if, and it might not even be an if, even though this regular season is probably going to be more experimental than most have been in the past, recent past.
Absolutely. And when I say at the top of this, you know, I'm a little pessimistic about the Spurs and their summer right now. Like, before the Spurs faithful come at me with their torch and pitchforks, like, pessimistic means like they're still going to roll through the regular season and win 50 plus games. It's about what they're trying to do in the postseason for how they match up against Golden State, Houston, and Oklahoma City, the other big three teams out west. I mean, they don't have a rim protector that's going to deter all of the shots at the rim that would come against Houston, because we know that's what they're all about. And I think Russell Westbrook dominates pretty much anybody unless they stick Kawhi Leonard on him. And then who guards Paul George? I mean, Danny Green, okay. Now where are you hiding guys like Parker and Aldridge? You know, there's too many scorers on the court for teams like that. And then they have nobody to guard for Oklahoma City either. So there's just a lot of questions defensively that make me scratch my head and say, you know, did they push the right buttons this summer to really exploit their strengths and do so enough to hide their weaknesses?
And the answer is no, right? Like, it's no, unless we can say unless, like, do they hit, like, is Murray all of a sudden just really good? You know, that helps them. He has that length. He has that little pop to him where maybe he's someone he could be that player that you're going to put on the explosive point guard so that it's not Danny Green as he's getting up there in age, so that it's not Kawhi Leonard, particularly when Kawhi Leonard isn't even available for you. And if you hit on him, that changes some things. If Rudy Gay's healthy, then you're a little bit better suited at the four. It's just, there are so many maybes, and I guess what I'm having trouble as we run around circles just grappling with, like, do you think that there are enough, if enough of these question marks are answered in the affirmative, you know, let's say Patty Mills and Javante Murray, like, they're fine leading an offense. And even if Kawhi Leonard comes back, he's going to make that. I could see him making that Kevin Durant leap as a playmaker that he did in Oklahoma City, where he all of a sudden averaged 5 assists per game. Sure. Is Kyle Anderson going to do anything for you defensively and kind of use anticipation instead of since he has a lack of speed like Joe Ingles does, I'll keep coming back to. He's fantastic at that. Do you think there are enough question marks to where if those are answered in the affirmative that the Spurs could be like almost as good, if not as good as last year, or have now they reached the point where even if everything or close to everything breaks right, like they're just not suited to stack up to these premier teams in the Western Conference?
It's so tough to say that, though, because you take a look at game one of the Spurs-Warriors series when Kawhi was healthy. Like, and you go back to the last regular season games that they had played. San Antonio was a legitimate challenger to Golden State last year. Like, it feels weird trying to write them off or say that there's something not right about the way that they're going about this right now. But they've changed a lot this summer with their identity. And again, with that, I think will come growing pains. We will see. Time is the only thing that can tell if the buttons that they're pressing in their front office and in their coaching staff are the right ones to maximize this roster even more. But at the end of the day, to me, it really does come down to LaMarcus Aldridge, who I kind of call the new Kevin Love, so to speak. When Love went to Cleveland right away and they were playing Golden State, it was kind of, well, he can't play the five and he can't defend anybody when he's at the four. And there's just, you know, it changes things to not have a guy that really finds a home on defense. And can you really beat a team that is so good like Golden State while you're working hard to find a place to hide somebody?
It's interesting because I was going to segue to LaMarcus Aldridge, who he was important just because he was so bad in the Western Conference Finals without Kawhi Leonard that he was instantly like he needed to be really good for this team to still be really good. And now with this quad injury for Leonard, if it does make him miss opening night, if not more, he's all of a sudden the featured weapon. And we were talking about rim protection before, and I brought this sheet up because I had it for something I was doing. I ranked the top 100 NBA players for Bleacher Report, which was just like that blew that, my head still hurts from that as I stutter. But 125 players defended at least 200 attempts at the rim. LaMarcus Aldridge ranked fifth in points allowed per shot. So it's not, we're not even saying like this is straight field, like this is points allowed per shot. And he was just behind Draymond Green, Rudy Gobert, Roy Hibbert, and Joel Embiid. His volume wasn't up there with Rudy Gobert, but it was around like, you know, Giannis Antetokounmpo level, Dwayne Dedman level. So that's not bad, and that's the appeal of the Spurs system for him on defense, is that you can still, if they're going to play him at center and he's going to be open to it, he might be able to survive there if you're going to get enough activity on the perimeter with and without Leonard too. But offensively, can he still be, and I lean towards yes, but can he still be that anchor? And that might be the more important question, because I feel like the Spurs are just always going to figure it out defensively. They by default, they're going to limit your number of possessions because they're so good at dictating pace no matter who is on the court. But last season, when Kawhi Leonard was on the bench, like the Spurs were demonstrative minus with LaMarcus Aldridge as the lead guy in those situations. Like it wasn't even kind of close. The exact number per NBA Wowie, they were scoring 99.7 points per 100 possession, which would have been worse than the Sixers' league low mark. Like that's a problem, because I don't think you look at this roster and say that it is appreciably better or even diversified enough that Aldridge could build upon that, unless he all of a sudden is he more comfortable in the Spurs system, do you think, this year? Do you think that him firing more threes would help? Are they going to maybe just run some more pick and pops for him? Like, how do you go about placating this guy's ego, which is among the most complex egos, I would say, in basketball, given what happened when he left Portland?
I mean, to be honest, I don't think Popovich really gives a shit about ego. He just coaches and takes the guy, and if you don't buy in, you're probably going to be out of there, or you're not going to be utilized in the way that you'd like to. So he'll get Aldridge to buy in a little bit. From what I've seen so far this preseason, and in looking at the sets and things that they ran last year, they play a lot through Pau Gasol at the elbows or in the low post, that they run similar type of triangle actions where they clear out one side and put the ball in Gasol's hands, or they put the ball in his hands about 18 feet away just beneath the top of the key, and they have cutters swirling all around him. Aldridge can space the floor to the corners for three. I don't doubt that too much. I think he'll be effective in that role and be able to be a secondary type of guy. But again, you're taking a guy who's such a good individual one-on-one scorer and relegating him to that role. He's not going to be so happy about it. Yet all the metrics say, all these tough turnaround twos that Aldridge lives on, and the amount that it sucks the energy out of the ball and the rest of the team by just eating possessions and not sharing the ball around the perimeter, it's detrimental to the Spurs as a whole. So while Aldridge may not conform and buy in, I think there's still a role for him somewhere. They'll find occasional post-ups for him. He can score a little bit off of the pick and roll and short rolls, but at the end of the day, it's been really fascinating to watch Pau Gasol kind of out-touch him and be more of a facilitator in this offense.
So what if we were to remove ego from the equation, what would be LaMarcus's Aldridge ideal role and function on this team? Like, what do the Spurs do to specifically just to maximize him at this point? What do they try and pigeonhole him into?
I think right now the Spurs are in flux a little bit because they don't have Tony Parker. They're changing parts quite a bit around the perimeter. The way Popovich can play and design an offense, he doesn't need one point guard. I mean, you watch a lot of their motion stuff. The ball moves seamlessly through the perimeter. Everybody gets a touch. So point guard and point guard dominant ball screen type of play isn't something that the Spurs are necessarily, you know, based upon. And I think the best way to utilize Aldridge would be as an off-ball screener, where he's able to slip up to the basket or force teams by being a good screener to switch. And then he gets mismatches that Popovich and the rest of the team don't feel quite as queasy about trying to exploit and pound the ball inside for one-on-one play. If he becomes a really good screener, and I know that's like the worst thing that people like to hear because they're looking for him flashy, like let's use him in this regard or put him at the high post or, you know, these complicated, like, no, if he becomes a good screener within the way that they play, he's going to get a lot more open looks that don't require him to hold the ball for 3 or 4 seconds of possession. I think that's the best way to utilize a guy like him.
And it is, and I was looking this up just as you started talking about his screening. Over the past 2 years since he came to San Antonio, he's been a role man on about 20% of his offensive possessions, and he's never even shot, like as a pick and roll diver, better than 46.1%, which is absolutely atrocious for people that don't like. He doesn't turn the ball over a bunch, but for that volume, if you're going to get more than 3 of those possessions a game, between 3 and 4 of those things, that's bad. Like, we're talking bottom third of the league, like in efficiency percentile. And the Spurs, while they're not a 3-point happy team, like they're very efficient about how they go about creating space. And to, I don't understand these numbers for a player of his caliber. He's never been exceptional around the rim, but like I feel most people into this role and they're going to shoot 50%+ on those looks. Like Dwayne Dedman was able to shoot 63% out of the pick and roll for them last year. It's just, I mean, Kawhi Leonard himself in his limited time as a roller shot 50% and he's a wing. David Lee shot 62%. So, but there's something, you know, Pau Gasol and the Marcus Aldridge, they don't have that explosive. Pau Gasol struggled there for them as well. And a lot of these, I guess it's those guys aren't diving either. And that's the problem, is they're rolling out for a lot of pick and pops where Dwayne Dedman is going to burst toward the basket. But I could see, isn't that supposed to be Aldridge's specialty too? Like, I feel like I'm going back and forth my own question here, but that is his ideal role. But is he even like, he needs to get, regain something that he's clearly lost, whether it was interest or touch, so that he can still be like the really good pick and pop option if he's not going to be that diver.
Yeah, I rewind it even a step further from that, not just what you do with the ball after you roll or where you roll to, but how you set the screen. And I watched the Spurs last spring, and he looks like he's not concerned about that. He's not concerned about setting a good, hard, solid screen to get his teammate open. And in a Popovich system, those are the little things that cause the rift. So for me, I'm not even worried about where is he popping to, where is he rolling to. It's the type of screens that he sets on those ball screens. And then there's off-ball screens, right? Those screens where, let's say, Tony Parker's dribbling it on the wing and Kawhi is cutting, you know, through the lane and trying to come out the opposite wing. What is Aldridge doing to set those screens and then try to, you know, inside pivot and seal, get a smaller defender on his backside and flash towards the ball? There are quick finishes and plays that you can get when you set screens for other guys that don't require you to post up, hold the ball, and jack up those crazy, you know, turnaround fadeaways that he's patented, you know, over the last few years. There's ways that he can score and be more efficient without dominating the ball. And I think that's what the Spurs system is all about, and that's what they need out of him if they're going to be able to get the most out of a group that really doesn't have many go-to scorers.
And it's probably more difficult than ever now to strike that balance if Kawhi Leonard misses any time. Like, we're talking a few games, because all of a sudden Aldridge can't just be that off-ball worker. You're going to need him to kind of pound it a little bit more.
That's right. That's right. And he and Kawhi, you know, they work pretty well together just because they're both, you know, Kawhi is just so, so good. They're virtually no flaws in his game anymore, and he makes everyone around him better. But like you said, when you don't have Kawhi on the floor, is it going to become the LaMarcus Aldridge show, which is very counterintuitive to everything in that organization, or is he going to find a way to be a go-to scorer without doing it in the way that he's always done it through his career in Portland?
And I would hope that there will be some middle ground, just because I don't know if you read the Michael Wright piece on ESPN.com, but Aldridge just straight out said he talked to Popovich about all this, and Pop and him are just now on the same page. And Pop had even said, like, you know, some of his concerns were valid. So maybe it's just, maybe that helps. Like, as stupid as it sounds, like maybe that conversation behind the scenes incites something for both, you know, coach and player.
Yeah, we can be hopeful in that regard. I mean, the post up is not dead. It's not something that every team needs to avoid, right? But it's on a team that's built on flow of your offense and ball movement and player movement. Throwing the ball inside and just back down, back down, back down kills that flow a little bit. And I think right now the talent gap between the Spurs and a lot of the top teams in the NBA is growing. Mm-hmm. And what's always been the differential for them that elevates that difference is their coaching, their system, and their culture. And when you have to change that or tweak it a little bit in order to make one of your guys happier, the end result is what really suffers.
Now, and another kind of, you move away from down low and the LaMarcus Aldridge existential or identity crisis or whatever the heck is happening over there. The point guard situation is fascinating because people, you know, some of them have been talking like, oh, they're out, like, until Tony Parker comes back, you have to, like, rely on Murray and Patty Mills. Even after Tony Parker comes back, like, this isn't, like, a good situation. He can still, if he's healthy, he'll get into the lane. And I think he's shown he can go through these spurts where if you put him in the corner, he'll drill some catch-and-shoot threebies. But, like, this point guard situation, regardless of how healthy Tony Parker is or when he comes back, it's just in flux. And I'm curious what you think the Spurs might lean toward more. Like, my own gut tells me that they'll try and cut Murray loose a little bit more so that Patty Mills' role doesn't have to change. But I honestly don't know, because we're talking about a team that is supposed to be definitely among the West top four, and that's not a squad that would typically turn to a sophomore to run its offense and then cover some really tough defensive assignments.
Well, first of all, Dan, I'm stealing the phrase 3B from you. I've never heard that before. You just threw that out there. Hey, I love that. A open free 3-pointer, a 3B. I'm using that.
Yeah, I mean, I dropped some good ones. If you ever need to really hurt your eyes, you can start reading me more, and I'll drop some good made up words every once in a while.
That is fantastic, 3B. But getting back to your question, I'm looking at the Spurs roster and kind of depth charts right now. I tend to break players down not in the typical point guard, shooting guard, small forward, power forward, center type of mold, but there are guards, wings, forwards, and posts and four positions. And I think the Spurs really have seven guards.
Okay.
Being Parker, Mills, Murray, rookie Derek White, and then Ginobili, Paul, and Forbes. I think of all seven of those guys as guards.
Oh, I forgot about I just forgot about Ginobili, and he's like, he's fantastic when he's like, he's still so fun to watch. I don't know how effective he'll be, but I can't believe I actually forgot about Manu Ginobili. So I would like to shame myself.
He's great for 17 minutes a game for 65 games in the regular season. I mean, it's one of those things where, again, the Spurs will just kind of ho-hum experiment with things during the regular season. And then, oh yeah, there's Manu, and he can still ball. Like, every April, it's the same story. But it's October now, so we can forget about it. The value in Murray, in my mind, comes from his ability, based on his length, to guard up a little bit. That he's really the key to this entire backcourt rotation for them. Because even when Parker returns, they're going to have guys like Parker, Mills, and Ginobili that they're going to want to play minutes. And we've seen it before, like Tony Parker and Patty Mills cannot guard up a position. They just can't. They're smaller guards, and they really will struggle with the more physical wings in the league. That's where Murray comes in. They can go smaller and put Kawhi at the four and have pretty good spacing around with, you know, Danny Green, DeJounte, and Mills or Parker. And that's probably going to be their most potent lineup because, like you said, it's a lot to ask of a sophomore to run the show. But with San Antonio's scheme, they're not ball dominant. A point guard isn't the guy that plays with the ball in his hands a lot. I think Gasol and Kawhi Leonard are their two primary playmakers right now. Even when Tony Parker returns, it's still going to be those two guys. And that fits with Patty Mills when he's on the floor. He's best as a knockdown three-point shooter and a re-penetration specialist. Somebody else kicks the ball out to him. He'll attack a poor closeout and make the right play from there. So Murray is a sophomore. His biggest thing is going to be on defense. He's going to have to step up to those defensive matchups and find somebody to mark in an impactful way that doesn't leave Kawhi Leonard, you know, battered and bruised after an 82-game season.
Yeah, and you know what? One of the things that I guess could be used as comfort is that if they're able to kind of follow the model that you lay out, and like that's how it's like this point guard by committee almost, but you playmaker by committee, like whatever you want to call it. If they can find a way to shoot those gaps, and especially once Kawhi Leonard comes back, I think that becomes exponentially easier. They still just find a way to score points. Like last year, they scored 113 points per 100 possessions, which would have been about second in the league when Patty Mills played without Kawhi, Manu, and Tony Parker. And the defense was fine during that time because the Spurs' defense is always fine. And that's like, maybe there are more options than we give them credit for. And I mean, Manu Ginobili, you know, he's good for kind of initiating the offense a ton. And that's, you don't play him more necessarily if Leonard is injured. But they just have, I guess they have a lot of ways that maybe we're us underestimating to some extent of bridging some of these certain gaps. Like the front court problems and the switchability there, that might be bigger than any issue they have on the perimeter, and that includes however long Kawhi Leonard is out.
Yeah. Here's a challenge to any listeners or you yourself, Dan, is to go, if you have NBA League Pass, they have these condensed games where you can watch the highlights,
right,
the scoring plays, the recaps of games that are played. Go watch some of the Spurs against, I don't know, run-of-the-mill NBA team. Not some of the elite teams, but, you know, the average to below-average teams. Like, watch theirs against Orlando from the other night. And if you watch that and you're looking for the way that they pass the ball and the amount of times the ball hits the floor on a scoring possession, it's going to be really amazing to watch. Like, they do a great job across the board of sharing the ball and moving it and letting the ball be the onus on deciding where the shot comes from, not dribble penetration, not ball screens, not pounding the crap out of it on the floor for 8 seconds of possession. It's unbelievable to watch. It's so much fun. It's what us basketball purists really love to see. And I don't think that changes based on their personnel too much. I think that's systemic now for guys when they come to the Spurs. They know what they're getting themselves into, and the Spurs only get guys that are going to be great passers in that regard. So when we talk about all these different guards and kind of point guard roulette and, you know, which big man will they slot into for their wonky defensive rotations and alignments out of that, again, to me, I don't worry about the offense at all. And it's inverse from years past with the Spurs, who have always been so good on defense and have continued to tinker with things and evolve on offense. Now the inverse is true. They have tinkered enough with the offense and evolved through time that they're going to be golden no matter what. But they have to solve the problem of defending mobile fours and protecting the rim against the great slashers and driving guards out west. And it's really tough for them to do in a one-stop shop, if you will, that they can't, you can't find one rotation that accomplishes both things for the Spurs.
No, you can't. And I don't even know how they address it. Like what you favor more given their roster makeup, because when you look at the splits of when Kawhi Leonard and LaMarcus Aldridge played without any bigs on the court, like they're not necessarily great. Like first of all, the Spurs really went to it because I feel like they don't trust it. They don't want to play Kawhi Leonard at the four. And I guess one of the major differences now is you don't have to play Kawhi Leonard at the four with Rudy Gay there and you have Bertans. But who do you look to on this roster as, you know, you say they don't have the entire package solution, but who do you think is going to play the biggest role if the Spurs are able to even address this in you know, like the majority somehow, if they're able to do better, like defending these mobile fours or just make the small ball model work. Like, who's the player that you're, you know, we know Leonard's going to stay at three and Aldridge is at the five. Who are you looking to, like, that might surprise us at the four? Is it still Rudy Gay? Is it Bertans? Are we counting on Kyle Anderson to turn into something finally?
It's probably Rudy Gay. You know, he is perhaps he's been so overrated because of his scoring ability early in his career. He was so overrated that he became underrated because people have written him off for so long. He's still a really good player, a really, really good player. And the Spurs getting him for the mid-level was a steal and a bargain this year. He's going to make plays and make them better by being there. Because whose spot is he? He's taken David Lee, his spot in the rotation. Like, that's an upgrade for the Spurs by far. I think he's a little bit better defensively than a lot of times we give him credit for, at least because he's a decent rebounder. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times if you can pressure elsewhere and you know Kawhi is going to do a good job on defense, Danny Green is still a pretty solid defender. You know, Murray has length. Patty Mills is feisty. If you can force shots from the perimeter, I don't worry about downsizing and the effect that might have on your rebounding. It's, again, the pick and roll stuff that you have to worry about with whoever their five is. I think they've solved the issue of the four, but they haven't solved the issue of the five. And when you solve who you put at the four and you downsize a little bit, you're now putting a huge target on the guy who's the five to be your primary ball screen defender, because there is nothing behind him to help protect the rim, right? Mm-hmm. If you elevate Pau Gasol by making him defend a ball screen and he comes out of the paint, who is there that can protect the rim? It's not Gay, it's not Leonard, it's not Green, it's not whoever the point guard is. You know, you are doing a much better job of opening up the rim. And to me, that's where their scheme is going to have to be such that keeps Gasol or Aldridge closer to the rim. And they, again, let their guards ping around on top of those high ball screens and side ball screens day in and day out, night in, night out. And it's going to be really, really tiring for their backcourt.
Do you think they could have been, and I know everyone thought, including myself, that they might have gotten into the Chris Paul sweepstakes, but his situation never even got that far. They still could have been more aggressive in how they approached it. Do you think, and the Pau Gasol's deal makes me think this, like where you gave him 2 years of all that money and then you have the, it's kind of a substantial guarantee in year three. I think it's a $6.7 million of his salaries guaranteed. And like to just waive him, like that's a $6.7 million cap hit. It's not the full mid-level exception money, but that's a lot if you get rid of him. I'm wondering if, I don't want to use the phrase that they were just kicking the can down the road because they knew that LaMarcus Aldridge maybe is going to opt in next summer because of the market crunch. And now they're kind of looking at, we're not even talking about 2018, but maybe the 2019 summer as the actual reset. Or maybe they're viewing this somehow as a one-year placeholder because LaMarcus can still opt out. I'm curious because we know, like you've talked about these issues, and these are issues, it wasn't even this season. Like we saw it against the Oklahoma City Thunder the year before. They just looked outmatched against these smaller, quicker lineups, and it just seems that they could have put their foot down to try and address this solution a little bit more, and they kind of didn't. They like accepted like the bare minimum or were cool with just treading water or just trying to, it almost feels like they just want to see these next 2 years through with, you know, until they know, I guess, Aldridge is gone. And I've tried to wrap my head around that for the entire summer and have yet to kind of come up with a definitive take.
I don't know if I could either. It's a lot. The cap situation for the Spurs is kind of murky. And I wrote about this in the piece for NBA Math at the beginning of the summer. You know, there's a lot of talk about who is it that they're going to target next summer. Do they have enough cash to, you know, go after the Golden Goose and LeBron or any of these other guys that can help move things forward? It really all depends on the guys that they, you know, that we're talking about that are huge question marks. It's LaMarcus Aldridge. It's Tony Parker and his health. It's Rudy Gay to some degree because he has a player option. Like, these are the guys that are going to determine how much they have, because Aldridge and Gay, player options. And I can't remember who was the guest on the pod. Zach Lowe did a podcast last week and was talking about kind of the residual effects of, okay, maybe the Spurs don't want Aldridge, but wouldn't you rather have Aldridge and try to flip his asset, or at least have him, than to just let him walk away in free agency? Like, it's more valuable to have a guy who's slightly overpaid and might not be the ideal fit than it is to have nobody. And that's something I really struggle with right now, because, you know, you could say, okay, well, what if Aldridge leaves? The Spurs aren't in a better position, because sure, they can go out and they can sign guys, but the money that it takes to sign a new free agent with bird rights and incentives is really costly in comparison to all those things. So we can be, you know, counting down the days until Tony Parker retires and Gasol retires and LaMarcus Aldridge opts out and say, okay, great, we got a fresh slate. It's still really expensive to go out there and swing for the fences for top level talent to surround Kawhi Leonard. Doing it via trade is the best way to do it. And Aldridge's trade value, unfortunately, is pretty low. We found that out in June when the Spurs were shopping him before the draft.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if he opts in and he's on an expiring contract and there's a team looking to create cap space or something and wants that deal, that's when he becomes a trade asset, would be next season. I honestly don't know what he's going to do with his contract, because it's such a murky situation. I think Zach Lowe even recently talked about that in an article. And, you know, you talk about how difficult it is to kind of rebuild through free agency right now. You're just a million percent right, because the Spurs' quickest path to max cap space, or the most efficient one, would be they need Danny Green, LaMarcus Aldridge, and to opt out, and then they can get rid of Kyle Anderson, and then all of a sudden you have a bunch of qualifying offers and non-guaranteed deals you work with, and that's your path to $35+ million in room. But Danny Green means something to you. Like, that's a player, if he opts out, you don't just renounce his cap hold. He's a very important defender. He's still a pretty good shooter. And once you keep his cap hold in there, or if you assume that he even opts in and that's $10 million right there, they needed Gay to opt out too. Excuse me, that was the one I missed. Like, you're one depending on all these guys to opt out, and it's not a given. And if you want to keep Danny Green, getting to max cap space is it's almost impossible. You would have to gut, like, everything around Kawhi Leonard, Danny Green, and Pau Gasol.
That's right. A lot of people, when they look at salary cap information, I don't think that they look at it correctly. They see, you know, max cap space. If you go on any of these numbers, you know, B-Ball Insider, SpotTrack, whatever it is, there are a lot of great websites out there. But I don't think that they have metrics that people know how to use when it comes to predicting cap space. So when I take a look at San Antonio's roster, with all of the guys that they have as of now that would be under contract for next year's 2018-2019 season, the maximum amount of cap space that they could have is $43.8 million, roughly. Which you hear that number and you say, great, we can go out there and get, you know, a LeBron James and chase him and throw a max contract out there. But then you have to think about how much of that is team controlled, right? How many of the decisions to get that cap space are ones that the Spurs as an organization can make? How many of them are not player options, essentially?
Right. And it's not a lot.
If every single guy were to opt in, they have less than $1 million.
Right.
Less than $1 million under the cap, and they have 11 guys under contract.
Yeah, it's crazy, but at the same time, it almost was, at least this offseason, it was there. I don't know what that Pau Gasol deal is. It puzzles the hell out of me. Like, but you gave Rudy Gay the player option. Like, you didn't have to do that. Like, if you weren't, I guess, committed to just seeing what you have now through for the next 2 years. Because, like, that is a weird decision as well. Like, to give him the power to, if you were hell-bent on having cap space, you would have, like, drawn a hard line there. And if it meant missing out on Rudy Gay because you didn't have more money to spend, well, okay, you missed out on a 30-year-old Rudy Gay who's coming off an Achilles injury.
Yeah, and people talk about, well, what are the Spurs? It'll be free agency next year, free agency, free agency. Like, I really do think Aldridge is going to opt in. I really do. And if he doesn't, again, the Spurs are going to struggle just to let him go for nothing.
Yeah.
Unless they get like LeBron James or a legitimate difference maker, like a legitimate top guy, they're going to struggle letting Aldridge go for that. You know, the Pau Gasol deal is mind blowing because you take that $16.8 million next year off the books. Like
the party changes.
That they can go after some guys, but it's I don't know, those moves this summer, the gay player option, like, yeah, I don't know if it necessarily had to be a player option, but I did, you know, I think having Gay is a good thing for them. But there's too many guys on this roster right now that I look at and I see it's going to be hard to move them if you have to move them and create something. And where else is the improvement going to come from? Because free agency is going to be tough. All you have really are those mid-level exceptions.
And again, it comes back to, it makes you think, and I tend to lean towards you. I almost feel like this, maybe LaMarcus Aldridge still opts out. Maybe, but this is probably the Spurs operating under the assumption that they're not going to lose LaMarcus Aldridge even if he opts out then, maybe. Because they know he's not getting, I think we can agree, I would be shocked if he got $22.3 million a year on the open market next year, which is what he would be owed. So if you're going to re-sign him at a lower number, maybe that deal becomes easier to move. Maybe it's more palatable down the line. But the Spurs are a smart organization, and they don't divulge much. But their moves are typically almost easy to read, and this summer was just not. And a lot of it comes back to the cap. Like, I mean, not the cap, but like just the decisions there. Again, the gay player option, it makes us all of a sudden say, well, then what are they doing? Like, they gave Pau Gasol this extra year. They have to have a hunch that like it's not as easy to pivot into something different anytime soon, because you don't give out, in my opinion, that player option to Gay. And you definitely, I don't care if it got you in a position to possibly, maybe if you're lucky, get in a room with Chris Paul, you don't give a 3-year, $48 million deal to Pau Gasol. Even if you want to subtract $10 million off the top of that, where it's essentially this 2-year, like $40 million, or 2-year $38 million, 2-year $39 million. You don't do that unless you don't think that it's going to be easier to pivot out of what you're doing now, or whether something different will be readily accessible if you were to pivot out of it.
And even on the other end of the spectrum, the Spurs have spent their last two first-round draft picks on point guards. They just re-signed Patty Mills. He's going to make $12.5 million next year. He's signed for, what is it, like $48 million over the next 4 years? And then Tony Parker's a free agent next year. What happens if Tony Parker doesn't want to retire and wants to keep playing? Are you really going to throw $8 or $9 million a year at him if that's what he's asking for, and then lock, you know, four roster spots and $24 million up in point guards when you already have all of this other fat around them with Aldridge and Gasol? And I mean, it's so many variables right now that it's a unique position, because we haven't, you're exactly right, the Spurs are usually pretty predictable. We haven't seen them be in a situation where kind of the cards are on the table and somebody else is holding the next card to play. And right now I think that the other guys on their roster with all those player options hold that deck, the rest of the cards in their hand.
I think we can agree, and I think it might be, this has been like, for a Spurs podcast, what we would be typically used to, it's been heavy. Like, I don't know if you feel that weight. It's been heavy because of all the unknowns. If we're just talking objectively, like we're talking, LeBron wants to win a title. LeBron wants to play great and, you know, wants to play great well into his 30s, probably closer to 40. Like, the Spurs are just a match with the way they preserve players. Perhaps that's actually what they were thinking about, whereas we're not doubling down on this free agency thing, but we know LeBron's going to be out there. And if he gives an inkling that he wants to come, like, you know, they don't have none of these deals. Maybe with the exception of Gasol, but I think because that third year is non-guaranteed, you could sweeten it with something. If LeBron came and said, hey, I want to come to San Antonio, but I'm not taking less than the max, like, the Spurs still have a path to get there. It's guttural, of course, but there's still that path, and maybe that's just what they said. Like, we're going to figure this out, and maybe they haven't figured anything out. They just wanted to be semi-flexible, and I guess that's kind of what they are.
You make some good points about the attractiveness of the Spurs to a guy like LeBron James.
He's not a system guy like that. Yeah, I know. It was like that. Well, it's you know how the Warriors said, like, it was so much, it would be so much easier for them to incorporate Kevin Durant than it would have been LeBron last year.
Right. That's not even my objection. I just can't, I can't get past the thought of LeBron going west.
It'd be idiotic, yeah.
It would be. I mean, who's the top threat in the East right now? Like Celtics and Wizards, like he's steamrolled through them. They've steamrolled those guys. I'm still not sold that the Celtics got better with the Kyrie Irving trade. Like that one.
Oh my God! Finally, someone. They lost value this summer. Like just look at everyone they lost.
They did. They lost an identity more than anything else. And again, that might be the coach in me talking a little bit too much, but that's going to be really strange. You know who I think it's either third or fourth. I'm going to double check this one before I really go out there and float it around. Yeah, you know who the fourth longest tenured Boston Celtic is?
The fourth longest? It's got to be Al Horford.
Okay, so we have...
Like, Terry Rozier is the second longest tenured Celtic right now.
Yeah, it's Al Horford. Al Horford is. We have Marcus Smart, Terry Rozier, Jaylen Brown, and Al Horford. Do you know who's fifth?
Is it Gordon Hayward at this point? Because he signed before Kyrie was traded?
Jason Tatum. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jason Tatum has not played a game in the NBA, and he's the fifth longest tenured player on a team that we're expecting to dethrone LeBron James.
Is that... they turned over almost two-thirds of their roster, and they got rid of three starters. Like, that is, like, a total disregard for continuity, and maybe this is the Spurs' play for continuity. Like, the Celtics are planning for the future, it seems, more than the Spurs are at this point. Like, they kept most of their starting lineup. Like, their core is intact. Like, they kept everything intact, and they're trying to kind of just add and tweak and push and pull where they can.
Yeah, and you take a look at the Celtics, their cap sheet is almost orgasmic at this point. It's so meticulous and clean, and there's a path to keeping all these guys for a long term. And the Spurs don't necessarily have that, but what they do have is continuity and identity, and hopefully that all of these small tweaks that they're making with going a little bit smaller and trying to change things a little bit to match better to Golden State, don't compromise that, because that really is and always has been the biggest value of the San Antonio Spurs.
I'm going to try and put you on the spot here with a couple rapid-fire questions.
Let's do it.
Who is going to end up being more impactful next year on the Spurs, Murray, Bertans, or Kyle Anderson? This season, I should say. Wow, I'm talking like it's still June.
Murray. I think definitely Murray. He's good.
Do you think like this is going to be a year where we start to – I mean, he's a sophomore, but do you think we're just going to look at him and be like, wow, he's putting it together already?
I think he's probably like a 9-5-3 type of guy, which is pretty good. You know, those are good numbers. And – I think a lot of it will be kind of the basketball Twitter falls in love with him, but nobody thinks of him as like this top of the line type of guy. Like he's, I think probably similar to what Marcus Smart was in his second year in the league. Like the expectations are high. People know about him, but kind of the biggest impact that he makes is on defense, but he's quietly like solid on offense.
And a better shooter than Marcus Smart, I hope.
Yeah, that's hard to not be.
He does shoot them. I got to give Marcus Smart credit for that. He lets them fly. Wow, I lost my train of thought because we went into a Marcus Smart tangent. So where do you kind of see the Spurs ultimately ending up in the West? Or what do you think their ceiling is in the West Conference? Let's go there first if mostly everything breaks right for them.
Okay, well... I am a firm believer in, and this is going to sound like the weirdest answer to your question, but I'm a firm believer that you don't tank.
Okay. Ever.
And the reason for that is because you never know. Every team is kind of one injury away from sliding up the totem pole. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So Golden State, they're fantastic, and they're probably built to endure one injury. Like, they were fine without Durant for a long stretch last year. But you never know if there's two guys, or, you know, knock on wood, something happens and a couple of guys are out for the year and can't come back. Everybody else slots up one spot, or at least the gap narrows. For the Spurs, the best case scenario for them, without putting health into the equation, is probably the two seed. They do what they do, ho-hum through the regular season, just win games, push the right buttons, get through that, and then lose in the Western Conference Finals. I think without injury, that's probably their best case scenario. But you, again, you're one or two injuries away, and hell, if Kawhi Leonard didn't get hurt last season, we might have had a really compelling Western Conference Finals.
Oh, that's so annoying.
I know. That's going to be like 10 years from now. That's going to be one of the bigger what ifs that we're talking about, I think. What would happen if Kawhi Leonard were really healthy? Because I don't know. That'll always stick with me. But and to me, that's their best case scenario, is kind of two seed in the West, 55 to 60 wins in that range, and Western Conference Finals.
What would you see their worst case scenario as being?
Worst case scenario is this injury on Kawhi nags and really weighs them down. They win 48 games, are the four seed, and have a tough time in the first round with either Denver or Minnesota, kind of defending the uniqueness, barely scrape by, and then just get clobbered by the Warriors.
And so do you think, and that this was like kind of supposed to tie into that rapid fire part that just went off the rails because my train of thought just evaporated. where are they going to rank in terms of points allowed per 100 possessions? Like, let's just keep it basic. Are they going to, can they have the league best defense again as they did last year and as they always seem to have?
I want to say yes, because I would have in no way looked at their roster from last year and thought that they would have the league's top defense, yet they did. It's definitely possible that they can. I'm trying off the top of my head to think of five teams that are better. I think the Warriors are. I'm a big fan in the Jazz defense with Gobert in the middle there. I think they're fantastic with that. Beyond that, not too many teams are jumping out at me as, you know, absolutely elite. So yeah, for sure.
Top three then again. So that's the trade-off you make, there might be an argument if we're going to assume Kawhi Leonard's healthy. And that was going to be my other question, was who's going to average more? But I'll tie it into that. If Kawhi Leonard's healthy, like, we're probably looking at a team that could be top three offense now. And if the trade-off to jump up, like, maybe not, or top five, but if you can, you know, if you're still going to be a top three defense and you can leap a couple spots on offense, you're maybe better suited to hit some more threes or space the floor or open up lanes for your point guards. Maybe that's just the thought process here, is the Spurs know they're going to churn out a top three defense no matter what.
Yeah. Hopefully. Again, Greg Popovich is so much smarter than I am. I'm a Division III assistant coach. I don't have much on Greg Popovich, so I'm going to trust his judgment and that the buttons that they've pressed are going to be the right ones, because I don't know. I've been watching the NBA for pretty much ever since he took over. I was, I think, 3 or 4 years old when he got the head coaching job there. And I've been watching the NBA ever since he's been there. I've never seen the Spurs suck. So why would I bet against them now, you know?
And this is the question I wanted to tie into that I meant to ask earlier. Who, the entire, what I thought was going to happen this year, and let's just assume Kawhi's healthy and comes back soon, was that he was going to make just another leap as a playmaker. We saw it, like, in the playoffs. He just carried that offense, and he averaged 4.6 assists per game. And I could see him stepping above that. Who averages, assuming Kawhi Leonard is healthy, who averages more assists this year, Kevin Durant or Kawhi Leonard?
Oh, Kawhi Leonard. Oh, I'm going to say Kawhi. That's a tough one.
I'm glad you found that tough, because I found it interesting. I wanted to know if I was the only one.
Yeah, I think the reason I'll go with Kawhi is because I think there are more playmakers – that'll rack up assists in Golden State than there are in San Antonio. I think Steph, Draymond, Iguodala all take away more assists that are available than any of the guys in supporting cast in San Antonio.
And if, before I get to where you, your gut feeling on where you just think what, how the season's going to end up for them win-wise and place in the Western Conference, if Greg, if they win, let's say another 55 games, if they're the third or second seed in the West again with this team, I think that looks less talented than last year's team did on paper, and is definitely, if you look at the teams of the past 5 to 6 years, they're, you know, they don't look among the best talented. Is Greg Popovich just a shoo-in for the Coach of the Year award? Because I think a lot of people grappled with it last year, and even when I was making hypothetical picks, I struggled with it because I wanted to give it to him, not because Pop is, well, yes, because Pop is so good, but not because this is the Greg Popovich award, but like, look at what he did with a team that did not look like it was built to win 61 games.
There's always a case to be made for Popovich for Coach of the Year.
Fair
enough. And we see it year in and year out. He is the best coach in the NBA. He should win Coach of the Year every season, but you never know what more kind of remarkable jump up in the standings based on preseason predictions is going to take place. Like, I would have had a really tough time not voting for Eric Spoelstra last year because of what he did to turn around the, like, they finished the season 500. They won 70%, 75% of their games in the second half of the season in order to do so. Like, they, if you win 70% of your games and you still miss the playoffs after that long of a stretch of time, like, you got to go back to the start of that and be like, what is it that you're playing for? What motivation do you have to keep winning like that? Like, it's, that is an unbelievable coaching job to me. So, without getting off on a tangent and talking about just my man crush for like 15 of the 30 coaches in the NBA, like, Popovich, it's easy to say he's a shoo-in, but there are a lot of good coaches out there in this league that will, I think, defy expectations in a way where right now the Spurs don't, because we just kind of say, well, they're the Spurs and it's what they do.
And gut check time. What do you see win totals for this team? Let's try and put it down to like a 2 or 3 win window and their ultimate place in the Western Conference.
All right. I'm going to go with 3 seed behind Golden State and Houston.
Ooh.
At 50. How do I want to do this here? I'm going to say 57 wins.
Wow. If this team, I'm sorry, if this team gets 57 wins, Greg Popovich coach of the year. Like, he has to be. I'm sorry. Just look at the roster. Like, you have to be coach of the year in that situation.
Yeah. It's going to be hard to vote against that. But yeah, 57 wins. And just because I just have a really hard time with the Houston Rockets right now, I'm saying the Spurs go to the Western Conference Finals.
Woof. It's weird. I don't have anything to add to that because I just agree. I think they're going to be 55-plus again. I'm not sure how the playoffs are going to shake out. The Thunder are more intimidating to me than the Rockets, but everything you just said, like, I don't know if this is blind faith or if I think that the small ball lineups are going to, they're going to play more and they're just going to work because the Spurs are going to, they're just going to do what they do, but I just see 55-plus for them, and it would not shock me if they're number two in the West. It would not shock me if they made it to the Western Conference Finals.
Yeah, and remember how I started this pod, Dan? I said I was pessimistic about their summer. So
and this is what you're predicting. Man, Spurs fans have it good.
That's right.
Well, I want to thank Adam for jumping on. It's always a pleasure. This was a blast that we were able to do this again before you get crazy with your in-game coaching schedule and recruiting and grad school and before the season gets underway. So this was great. Thank you for giving us so much of your time. If our listeners would like to get at Adam Spinella for being too low on the Spurs, I mean, 57 wins is less than 70. So if you want to get Adam and call him out for being so low on them, you can follow him at Spinella14. That's at SPINELLA14. He, again, is a Washington and Jefferson assistant men's basketball coach. He writes for us over at NBA Math. You can find him at B-Ball Breakdown and Fast Model. He is everywhere. If you want to talk to me, you can find me at Dan Favale. That's F-A-V-A-L-E. If you want to talk to my esteemed co-host, Andy Bailey, he's at Andrew D. Bailey, spelled exactly like it sounds. Please follow the NBA Math official account at NBA underscore math. You can follow Hardwood Knox at Hardwood Knox. Since Andy is here, there will be no shout out to you know who. So until next time.